Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell. I'm here today with Megan Clougherty,
who's
just back from vacation, and bits and pieces of her are
I'm a little injured.
But she's, you know, enthusiastic and forward thinking and everything else that we try to be here on the podcast. Joining us today is an old friend, Steve Buttrey.
Very old.
Very old. old in and that we've known him for a few years. Steve was on a couple of our earliest podcasts, talking about his time at Digital First Media's Project Thunderdome, which, as we reported recently, because we had Jim Brady in, Project Thunderdome went the way of, I guess, the Thunderbird. It sort of crashed and burned. But Steve is going to be soon on to other things. The reason we invited Steve in was, first of all, welcome, Steve.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
The reason we invited Steve in was because he's posted a few things on Facebook and his own blog about the New York Times Digital Innovation Report that just came out recently. And we thought that would be pretty good fodder for us to sort of discuss what it says, what it means, you know, that sort of thing. So let's sort of start with that. What do you think? What's your first blush take on it when you first saw it?
Sure. It was interesting because many of us in journalism think of the New York Times as this shining beacon of digital journalism success. You know, they did the famous Snowfall interactive project that won a Pulitzer Prize and got a lot of buzz in the business about being a new way of telling stories using all the digital opportunities. And part of the discussion also was, well, yeah, but we can't do that. We're not the New York Times. We don't have, you know, can't put a developer on a story or multiple developers, whatever it took to make that fabulous project. They do, you know, they've got an R&D team that's gotten a lot of attention and so on. So that there's this notion of the New York Times as having resources and digital abilities that the rest of us don't have. And the innovation report kind of was critical inside look at the digital capabilities and performance and retention of digital stars and everything that really sounded an alarm that says we're not doing nearly as well as we need to be. We're not doing as well as our digital-only competitors, and we've got to step up our game. And so my word to my digital-first colleagues and others in the newspaper business who are trying to figure out how to do print and digital together at the same time was, look, if the New York Times needs to reform how it works and how it thinks and become more digital first, then the rest of us certainly need to accelerate what we're doing. And it really played into, in fact, it quoted me and some of the things that I've written about our efforts to be more digital first at Digital First Media. And, you know, I said, we really need to step up our work. You know, yeah, we've made a lot of progress, but stop patting yourself on the back. We got a long way to go.
I was quite surprised when we get to the end of it and you realize that the whole report is almost a justification. Now we're going to be digital first. And people have been, your organization, sure, obviously, but people have been talking about digital first for 5 years at least. And people, sure, have been writing about it. So the fact that the New York Times is suddenly on board with this seems really kind of, I don't know.
Sure.
Redundant.
Redundant.
Digital First, I speak of our efforts at Digital First Media, and I immodestly think we've made more progress than most, if not all, print-rooted newsrooms in moving that direction. But I say digital first is not an achievement, certainly not a boast. It's an aspiration and it's a path that we're following. And when people asked about my position, digital transformation editor, people ask, okay, what's that? Which is not surprising. You know, I say that my job was to help our newsrooms and guide our newsrooms in moving further and faster and smarter down that digital path. So if we are among the farthest down that path, if not the farthest down that path, we certainly, you know, we certainly haven't gotten there, and so I don't think anybody else has. If anybody was ahead of us, I thought it was the New York Times, but the description of their focus on page one, for instance, is something that I think we've moved farther than them on. So, you know, they've got maybe more digital skills than All-Stars, although they just lost Aaron Pilhofer. So, and they documented in there how some of their digital talent is going and why some of their digital talent is leaving for digital-only operations where they think they can do better.
I remember when you were a professor at American University, and I know that you have some opinions about paywalls.
Sure.
What are your opinions about paywalls?
My opinions about paywalls are that paywalls are not the path to a prosperous future. You know, there's no non-newspaper company that is pinning a significant amount of its digital strategy on a paywall. Clayton Christensen, the Harvard business professor who's author of The Innovator's Dilemma and The Innovator's Solution and really the leading thinker on disruptive innovation, talks about how when there's a new technology opportunity, that legacy companies react to that by seeking to transport their old business model into the new space. And newspapers clearly did that with their advertising and subscription models. So I don't think the prosperous future is trying to make the ideal paywall work. The New York Times is a different situation because of two things, because it is the New York Times. It does have a level of quality people are more likely to pay for. Their meter model very cleverly worked out a way to catch a lot of the traffic from people who won't pay while getting the people who are willing to pay to fork over some money. It's very much a voluntary model. You know, if you hit the paywall, you just open up a new browser and go onto your phone instead of your laptop.
It's like
or whatever.
The glass box at the museum.
Sure.
Pay whatever you can.
And I think the New York Times could have realized similar revenue by going to a membership model, similar to NPR, or by seeking more innovative ways of making money, and they're going to probably do some of that too. But because they're at the top of the field, because they've got a quality that nobody else has, and because, frankly, a whole lot of their business comes from people who can write that off on their expense accounts or on their taxes because they're using it for business purposes, which isn't something a community newspaper's readers can do because we're counting on people, you know, at home to buy the paper and use our products for personal use. And so it's really different, but it certainly has been more successful than I thought it would be and more successful than most other newspapers have a right to be. So I'm still a paywall skeptic, but you can be a paywall skeptic and you still got to give it up to the New York Times. You can't pretend that hasn't had some level of success.
You were talking about legacy journalism. Ain't nobody bigger than the New York Times in America for legacy journalism, the New York Times. And there were a lot of people who would look to them for the answers in a lot of things regarding journalism and paywall, business model, whatever the New York Times is going to do. But the fact that, I've always been skeptical about the paywall just because I don't think if you look to try to implement the New York Times model elsewhere, it's just not going to scale because you don't have the same quality of content, the same type of audience, the same situation.
Though I thought that when they went to a paywall – that others would follow suit and it wouldn't go well. Where it seems like they kind of went out on a limb and other smartly organizations decided, we don't have that loyalty, we don't have that pull as much as I thought they would, I guess.
Well, there have been a whole lot, including my company that have, and Gannett, which is the only newspaper company bigger than us, who have gone to different versions of the paywall. There's one called All Access, which we have done, which basically raises the rate of a home subscription of the paper and says, well, we're going to raise your rate by 40%, 50%. I don't know what the percentage is, and it varies. But you get all access. You get free access to our digital platforms. Those newspapers are really, you know, they're counting that as digital revenue, but it's really print revenue. And in fact, we hear from our print subscribers, hey, I don't go to your website.
You're making me pay for that.
Yeah. And then we set the meters, you know, we experiment with the meters. What's the right level of the meter so that the people whose free traffic we want won't get turned away? So that is a challenge. You know, it's a different solution from the New York Times, but there's a whole lot of the newspaper business that is experimenting with some level of paywall, and not with nearly the success of the New York Times.
So let's get off paywalls for a second here. Going back to the innovation report, we talk about one of the things that the conclusions they came to was that a lot of the traffic for their stories, much of the traffic for stories was being generated elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, places like, you know, Huffington Post
aggregators.
Sure. That people were repurposing New York Times content and getting the hits for it where the New York Times wasn't getting the hits. So they saw that as a problem.
Which I guess would be a growing problem regardless. If aggregators are out there, it seemed to be like you could plan for that.
You know, I say this as somebody who has been aggregated by the New York Times in my report.
Well,
yeah. In my reporting and editing, I mean, you know, in addition to the fact that their innovation report cited me,
right,
in my reporting and editing days, stories that I did or my reporters did were cited in the New York Times, and my newspapers got no value for that. You know, we'd cover a big story. I was a reporter and editor in Iowa, Nebraska, and North Dakota, and Kansas City. And in most, if not all, of those locations, we'd cover a big local story that became a big national story that the New York Times would come and do. And they would either quote us or re-report facts we reported initially that they may have verified independently, but we still did them first. And so they were aggregating our work. We didn't call it aggregation then.
Mm-hmm.
And my newspapers got no value from that. We got kind of an ego boost.
Because they couldn't link
especially
back.
Because this was pre-linking.
Right.
And so following somebody else has always been standard journalism practice. You want to be first, and we try to be first. And the New York Times is first on a lot of national news stories. But in terms of the regional stories that suddenly become nationally important, the New York Times is almost never first. They're following local news organizations and aggregating their work. And so mm-hmm. what the Huffington Post does is exactly what the New York Times has been doing for years with an evolutionary step beyond that, and they almost invariably link to the New York Times and generate some traffic for it. Now, the New York Times doesn't get as much traffic out of that as Huffington Post, and they did comment on that in the innovation report, but they didn't comment on it in the way that Bill Keller did in his column a year or two ago. I think it was after he left being editor, but it might have been his late days of being editor, where he kind of got in a back and forth with Arianna Huffington about aggregation, and he was, you know, pretty much calling it theft. And
there are a lot of thieves in journalism.
Yeah. But the innovation report says, we got to figure out how to play in the digital world. You know, Huffington Post is getting all this benefit out of our digital content because mm-hmm. they're better at SEO than we are.
Oh, yeah. They're better at SEO than just about everybody.
Well, sure. And so they're saying, well, we're the New York Times. We should be as good at SEO as anybody. And so they're not whining and accusing. They're using it as a clarion call to their colleagues to say, we need to get as good at this as HuffPo is. And I like that.
Yeah. And I think the thing is that anybody's going to say that the quality of the journalism that New York Times produces is superb, generally.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think we can just say that. But journalism, I think, for a lot of people is not just the stories that you write and the things that you cover, but it's also the way you deliver your content to people. And what comes out of the report is that the paper that a lot of people look to for leadership or you know, groundbreaking areas in is behind in comparison to a lot of digital-only platforms.
Yes, yes. They're certainly not behind in relation to newspapers, but they cited you know, Vox and Politico and we, like we've already said, Huffington Post and BuzzFeed and some others that in various ways have an expertise or digital tools that that they don't match and that they need to get better at.
How do you think the Post is doing? I mean, obviously the Post is sort of starting to scale back, it seems like. And when you see the New York Times say we could do more, I just wonder if it's sort of like if the Post is looking to the Times for leadership there.
I think everybody is in journalism is watching the Post and saying, okay, Jeff Bezos has put $250 million, which was way more than Don Graham would have gotten if he had tried to sell to Warren Buffett, for instance, or who sat on the Post board, you know, and so he had a friendship there. And so there was a sense that, okay, here's a real digital innovator and disruptor, the guy who figured out, and I mean, for years before you know, when I was teaching disruption, I'm sure we talked about this in the class I had with you folks. The example of that I would use when I talked about Clayton Christensen and disruptive innovation, that newspapers tried to take our advertising and subscription model online, we had the opportunity and the sales force and the audience to succeed at what Jeff Bezos did on Amazon of selling things directly to people, or of what Piero Omidyar, who is also getting into the media business, did on eBay, which is helping people sell their stuff, which of course Amazon now does too. So I was very excited to see a digital disruptor of Bezos, both resources and accomplishments, get into the newspaper business. I wish I had seen, and it hasn't been that long, but I wish I had seen some sort of digital innovation from the Post that would make me say, "Oh my God, there he is! He's doing it now." Now I don't know if he's, you know, keeping a respectful distance for a while. If he's, you know, he's worrying about, you know, delivering Amazon products with drones and stuff. He still has his core business to do. So I don't know how much he's influencing the Post yet, or if he even plans to, but I'd sure love to see that innovative mindset running an old newspaper. And I think the Washington Post could get, you know, they certainly have great resources as well, especially now that they've got Bezos's resource. So I expect and hope to see them leading the way in some innovation, but we certainly haven't seen that yet out of the new ownership. But it hasn't been a year yet. So
the interesting,
they may be sneaking, you know, planning something that they're going to launch next week, and I'll, you know, shake
and then we'll
fist,
have you back,
shake my fist, and say, hey, can we redo that podcast?
But the interesting thing about the digital report by the New York Times is it's almost laughable in the sense that they do what they do best. They did a very, you know,
long story.
When it came down to it, they did a multi, you know, resource, lots of, you know, lots of graphs and things, some graphics, and they did a New York Times presentation of what their problems were. And they have a thing in there very much. They quote Clayton Christensen about disruption, and they even give a model, and they sort of break down what they are. It's like somebody sort of explaining why, what's going to happen to them if they don't change.
Sure.
And the big thing that they put on the table as well was the quality of their journalism. That's what their primary interest has always been in. But then it sort of brings up questions about scalability, whether if all they are going to do is create quality journalism, that costs money. And if they're going to be able to develop a model that allows them to do that level, or are they going to have to sort of change the way they do their job?
There might be some of both, and they certainly raised some questions of that we need to rethink whether everything needs to meet the standard of this, you know, of our very best journalism. But one of the points that relates directly to scalability, and I may not be quoting exactly, but that I think they were quoting one of the many people outside the Times that they interviewed, who said, I don't want a snowfall, I want a snowfall builder. Right. And I think that's part of how you scale, is that you get either a tool or a journalist or, you know, developer slash journalist or a team who can help anybody turn a great journalism project into snowfall quickly and efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
Which a guy, and I'm drawing a blank on it, I think his name is Cody Brown. And if I'm wrong on that, I'll apologize to Cody and to whoever it really is. But a guy named Cody Brown developed a tool that could do, and in fact, he did snowfall with his tool to demonstrate. And of course, the New York Times, with a copyright infringement, told him that he can't do that, and he had to take it down.
But it was just to show what it was capable of.
They could do. And so I think tools will become available, and probably sometimes developers will make better tools for the Times than whoever makes for other journalists to do, you know, the once you do snowfall, you can't do that for every story in terms of starting from scratch with the tools. But the next question is, like this person said in the report, okay, we need a snowfall builder tool. And I think that we'll see that kind of thing from the Times, as well as from some of their digital-only competitors.
Yeah, I think that was the theme that ran through a lot of it, is that there was sort of a degree of frustration about how many resources they put into developing Snowfall, and then, you know, how does you then translate that into future multimedia projects, other things that you're doing? And it sort of speaks to actually a shift in your newsroom strategy, which they do talk a bit about, where you have developers more involved in the process than it is right now.
Sure. I think that certainly one of the issues that they cited and went into great detail on was the need for more collaboration between journalists and other technology. They were very respectful of the what we call the church and state wall between advertising, but they said the rest of the business operation, the R&D, the technology, the distribution and promotion aspects, that journalism, the newsroom needs to be collaborating more with them, and I fully agree. I think you can even collaborate more with your advertising colleagues without endangering your integrity. You can talk about what are the products, what are the things that we're doing in terms of content that we're creating, so they can do a better job of selling it without you ever knowing who those customers are going to be. But I think on the technology side, at the Denver Post, our largest newsroom, we've got developers in the newsroom who are considered journalists and part of our storytelling teams. And we did a project, people can Google, I think, Storm Chaser. I think it's Storm Chaser and Denver Post. And they'll see something that's not quite at the snowfall, oh, wow, level. Man, it's good. It's a great interactive storytelling process. Well, we've got developers in the Denver Post newsroom that we respect and regard as fellow journalists, mm-hmm. who teach those, you know, who use digital tools better than the other journalists to help the journalists tell stories. And I was at a meeting, you know, not a meeting, a social gathering last night with Brian Boyer of NPR, formerly of the Chicago Tribune. And he actually came from an engineering background. He was a computer programmer by profession who, with a Knight News Challenge scholarship, went to grad school at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern to learn journalism. I started working with him when he was at Medill, and I was an editor in Iowa. And I was amazed at both his talent and his insight and how quickly he understood journalism. I thought, we need, you know, hundreds of Brian Boyers, even though there's just one, in newsrooms across the, and Brian is better known than his colleague in that program. There were two who went through Ryan Mark, but Ryan is head of the News Apps team at the Chicago Tribune and doing some fabulous work too. Huh. They both started out at the Trib, and Brian moved to NPR. And so I think we need more recognition of development as a journalism skill, of digital development as a journalism skill.
And we had Brian in on the podcast.
Oh, cool.
And it was, it was one of our one of our most popular ones. He had incredible insight into what a developer can do to sort of help journalists tell their story using data and other, you know, and APIs and other things to do that. And we also had Kat Downs in from the Washington Post, and it was a great podcast because she was talking about what she had just done the week before, which was all this multimedia around to support the Post's coverage of the Boston shootings. This is a common theme in a lot of our podcasts where, you know, the newsroom needs to open up and to bring these other people who have these other skill sets in and take advantage of what you have in the digital platform.
Especially because they think in a different way. I mean, like Brian's, you said, comes from an engineering background. It's just giving diversity to, you know, the approach.
And I think that's a type of diversity. I mean, I'm a big believer in improving our gender and racial and ethnic diversity. But I think diversity of backgrounds is a good thing, too. I think when you've got a person coming into journalism as a second career, whether they're coming from law. I've worked with journalists who came in from the ministry and from, oh my God, advertising.
Whoa.
And they all brought interest. I worked with a journalist who was a former country music singer and writer. And they all bring both skills and a viewpoint that really benefits their news organization.
Do you think, just going back quickly to the report, do you think, what was the point of the Times presenting it like that? Was it sort of to persuade people, this is why we're doing this, we need your money to get better? Or was it more just a, you know, we are self-aware and here's how?
Let's make clear that they didn't present it to the rest of the journalism world. They finished it like in March or something like that. And first, the first thing to come out was kind of the sanitized version that I'm sure somebody from the Times, you know, management probably leaked or something. I don't know how it came out. You know, they didn't release either one of them, but the first one that came out had some of the same points, but none of the criticism of the Times. They were trying to handle that more internally. And, of course, in a newsroom that big, it's not going to stay internal very long. And I think BuzzFeed was the one who actually published the leaked version, which, of course, the New York Times should have published it. You know, that's...
It just looks bad.
That's a transparency step that I don't know if they even addressed it, transparency in there.
I don't think they did.
That's a transparency step that old school journalists, and that this gets into journalism ethics, you know, the pointer guiding principles for the journalists, which came out last year, changed the core principles that they'd developed in their first guiding principles back in the 90s were truthfulness, which of course is still a core principle, but then the others were independence and minimizing harm. And they changed the second and third ones to transparency and community. Transparency is not fully embraced yet. I don't expect the rewrite of the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics to embrace transparency, certainly not as a core value, although I'm hopeful that they're going to do more than what they've done in their first draft, which they're meeting in August, and so that's still up in the air. But transparency is not fully embraced as a value in journalism. I think the New York Times recognized that by having this great roadmap for any newsroom that's trying to get better at digital, and instead of publishing that on their website and saying, here's what we're doing, or at least turning it over to, you know, Margaret Sullivan, and their public editor, and letting her publish it and comment on it first or whatever. Mm-hmm. Then it's published in BuzzFeed. There's a report about how the New York Times needs to get more like BuzzFeed. And where is it published? In BuzzFeed. No, they didn't say they need to get more like BuzzFeed. They did say they need to learn from BuzzFeed. And BuzzFeed published it. That tells you a lot.
BuzzFeed taught them a lesson.
Yeah.
This is transparency. This is exactly what you should be doing. If you're the leader of our industry, then you need to be leading. I think a lot of people were sort of surprised that, maybe they weren't surprised. I was surprised. I was surprised. I wasn't really surprised. But a lot of the first look at this material that was coming out, a lot of people was going back and forth. Can you believe the New York Times is like this? That they're not doing this. They're not doing that. But
they're not having a good month. That's for sure.
They're not having a good month. And you were the one who mentioned diversity in newsrooms.
Sure.
And the other thing that's been whirling around the New York Times has been the firing of Jill Abramson. Is that correct? You're looking at me very confused.
Yeah. I'm waiting for you to finish the question so I can pass.
Oh, so I got to form this into a question now. Right. So. And you, I saw that you had, I don't know if you'd actually written a blog post, but I saw on Facebook you'd made a few comments or shared some links about people who were writing about diversity in newsrooms, pay equity and things like that. I think the one that you posted yesterday, you pretty much said that when you came into the industry, that people, there was this disparity and there was this feeling in newsrooms that, that women were underrepresented.
Sure. Yes. I'll preface everything by saying I don't personally know Jill Abramson or Dean Baquet, her successor. And I'm not interviewing at the New York Times for anything. But if they want to call, they probably got somebody there who's good enough at Google to find my number or my email.
This is an exercise in transparency,
yes,
ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, okay. maybe too much transparency. So I'll get to the point. Every description of Jill Abramson as, you know, in terms of her management style, could have been made of at least half, if not more, of the male editors, both good and bad male editors that I've worked with. You know, to be pushy and abrasive and those sorts of things is, you know, that's part of being an editor. It's part of being in a newsroom. And so last year when Dylan Byers of Politico did a piece based entirely on unnamed sources, with the exception, as I recall, of Dean Baquet, who was confirming some things that he had heard, that Byers had heard and reported, but mostly, defending Abramson at that point. And it said that she had lost the newsroom. And I told about a time that somebody said I had lost the newsroom. And by the way, they were wrong. And let's be clear about one thing. Dylan Byer, you know, the fact that Jill Abramson got fired a year later doesn't confirm that Dylan Byers was right. If she had lost the newsroom, she wouldn't have lasted a year. Mm-hmm. Now, clearly, she might have lost some people, but Amanda Hess, my former TBD colleague, did a really nice piece about the women in the newsroom, or not the women, so many women, particularly younger women in the newsroom, who looked up to her. Also, I should say, based on unnamed sources, every effort Arthur Sulzberger has done to explain this has made him look worse and Abramson look better. And she was so classy in her commencement address at Wake Forest. So, you know, I think, okay, even if the publisher and the editor aren't working well together, the publisher wins that every single time and the editor has to go. Mm. But I wonder. And everybody I know who knows Dean Baquet thinks highly of him, and he's probably going to be every bit as good an editor as Jill Abramson. And maybe maybe he'll get along better with the newsroom and with the management team. But we do know for, you know, it was published in the Dylan Byers piece and has since been confirmed. And I think it was confirmed in the Dylan Byers piece that Becquet has enough of a temper that he pounded his fist on the wall in an argument with Abramson at one point. And we also know that he went around his editor to the publisher when he had a difference. You know, those are two things that you can do that might indicate he's going to have some trouble with some staff too. But I was an editor. I had trouble with staff occasionally. You know, the first
comes with the territory.
Yeah, I was going to say, any editor who is completely beloved by his or her staff and has never made anyone on the staff angry or disappointed probably isn't a good editor. Some journalists do need a kick in the tail or to be told bluntly what's wrong. And so I don't you know, if Jill Abramson had gotten if her communication with her publisher had broken down to the point that the publisher thought she wasn't being honest with him, she's going to be fired, and any man would be fired whose relationship with the publisher had broken down that severely. But I cannot imagine a woman who wasn't the executive editor getting away with going around the executive editor to the publisher. Now, maybe that's happened. Maybe somebody will correct me on that. But and the fact is that none of the 10 largest newspapers in the country now have a woman editor. Some of them, including the Times, have had women editors, but 10 to nothing is a pretty strong number. Two of the 25 biggest have women editors. You cannot tell me there's not a glass ceiling in newsrooms. Mm-hmm. And what you mentioned about the thing I reposted yesterday, Kristen Hare at the Pointer had a great piece. I don't know where she found it, in archives or somewhere. Somebody sent it to her. A 1960s guide for the Associated Press managing editors on dealing with women staffers, because women were coming onto staffs now, that said things about, you know, dealing with their constant emotional drives and things like that. Oh, that gosh. Were just amazingly insulting. And I started in the newspaper business in 1971. This was, you know, and some of the instances that Kristen was using were actually during my career, you know. And everybody had good explanations, in their view, for why there weren't more women in the newsroom. Well, you know, they raised the kids. They, you know, this and that. You know, we're hiring.
We need to pay them less as well.
Yeah, exactly. We're hiring based on experience and those sorts of things. You know, that's complete nonsense. You know, we have a gender discrimination in newsrooms that still persists. You know, my company, predominantly the editors are men. In 2013, I was heavily involved in hiring editors and increased both the ethnic and gender diversity, but didn't have nearly enough opportunities. And every one of them is doing well. If you broaden your horizons in looking for candidates, you can find really good candidates. If you look in, you know, if you're just basing on experience in a system that discriminates, you're going to continue discrimination. Right. So you need to look at the other attributes that candidates bring. And we've hired some really good editors who increased our gender and ethnic diversity.
Speaking of candidates,
uh-huh. What's your point?
What could possibly be my segue? Now that your term there at Project Thunderdome is sort of coming to an end, do you know what's next? Do you have any idea?
I am fairly far along in.
He's being wooed.
We want to break a story here. Yeah.
You're not going to break a story. I'm fairly far along in discussions with at least two prospects.
That's great.
So that I think I'll be making a choice in the next 2 or 3 weeks. There are other prospects that I'm not as far along with, but I'm trying to push. I mean, obviously, the fantasy is that there will be a bidding war for my services.
We're not laughing at you. We're hopeful for you.
That's good. But I think I'll have options, and I'm very confident that I'll have a job. But I have nothing to announce here today.
And your lovely wife will be willing to move yet again. She's like a world traveler.
Mimi worked at Creighton University when I worked at the Omaha World Herald, and benefits at Creighton and at some other universities include like free tuition for your kids, even tuition on exchanges with some other universities, and I compare that with the newspaper business where they just give you a discount for your paper so they can count you as a paying customer. And so after our kids, our three sons got through college, Creighton and Marquette universities, we had a deal that she would get to chase her dream of being a novelist. And she's got a novel out, Gathering String, that was published a couple of years ago and is working on two different sequels right now. Now, one of them's a sequel and one of them's completely unrelated. Two other novels right now. And so the nice thing both about our travel and about a move is she can write her novels wherever we happen to be.
Right.
So we would love to stay in the D.C. area, and we have some options that might take shape that would allow us to stay here. And while I married an Iowa farm girl who would like to stay in the same place a little longer, she's been very understanding about the opportunities and opportunities disguised as disappointments that have caused me to move a lot during my career. So we'll move if we need to move,
right.
but we do have some local opportunities too.
We'll be watching, obviously. He's everywhere on social media. Not hard to find.
I do tweet a little.
Little bit. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. And I'm just excited that this venture is... How long have you been doing It's All Journalism?
We are also about a year and a half. We're actually fast approaching our 100th episode.
All right. Excellent.
Woohoo! We're going to have to have a cake or something.
Yes. Two of my star former students.
Aww.
Excellent.
Making big bucks in the podcasting world.
There you go.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of digital news. Find more info on us and download other episodes at itsalljournalism.com. This podcast is produced in partnership with the Association of Alternative News Media. Thanks for listening.